This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkov in Washington. Neil Conan is on assignment in London. As the country prepares for war and the terrorism alert is at code orange, there is now yet another factor to consider. On Capitol Hill yesterday, U.S. intelligence officials said that North Korea may have a long-range missile that could reach the U.S. West Coast. The disclosure about missiles comes at a time when North Korea has said it is restarting a nuclear program that could lead to refining more bomb-grade nuclear material. Indeed, the CIA estimates that North Korea already has enough nuclear material to build one or two bombs. Understandably, much of the rest of the world is not too happy about all of this. North Korea may be willing to talk, but it is demanding unilateral talks with the United States. And the White House, for now at least, is deferring this matter to the United Nations and is calling on China to get North Korea to halt its growing nuclear program. Now, if this doesn't sound like the U.S. approach to Iraq, it's not. And later this hour, we will talk about how important consistency may or may not be in foreign policy. But first, we want to look more closely at these latest developments with North Korea. Joining us now is Robert Gallucci, Dean of the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He was ambassador at large and negotiated the agreed framework with North Korea in the Clinton administration. And he joins us now from his office at Georgetown University. Welcome, Robert Gallucci.
Thanks very much.
And if you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call here at 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Well, Robert Gallucci, it is said that North Korean missiles can reach the west coast of the United States. And I'm looking for a little more granularity there. Can we be more precise? What exactly are they talking about when they speak of the west coast of the U.S.?
I believe that talking about a missile that would is called a Taepodong missile, and this being a Taepodong 2. On the last day of August in 1998, the North Koreans tested the Taepodong 1, and they intended, they said, for this not to be a missile, but to be a rocket to put a satellite that would sing in orbit. It didn't work. They had problems with stage separation. I believe it was a three-stage rocket, and it didn't work, but it did show a capability to get some stage separation, to go some distance, and not all the way across the Pacific Ocean to the United States. But it suggested that with time, they would, and additional versions, and we know of two, a Taepodong 2 and 3, and we know the structure of those missiles, that they would get to intercontinental range, and that's a plausible expectation of the North Koreans. Whether they can now, in fact, reach the United States with a missile, I take the assessment as given yesterday as accurate, that the judgment of the experts is that they could. They certainly haven't tested anything like that, so I think you'd also have to put some probablys and possiblys into any assessment. You'd also have to observe that it would not be an accurate missile. It would have a huge, what's called circular error probability.
Mm-hmm.
But if one is delivering a nuclear warhead for the purpose of intimidating or threatening or deterring, that doesn't make a huge amount of difference.
Right. So once again, when they were speaking of the West Coast, they were talking about the continental U.S., or were they counting Hawaii as hitting the U.S.?
I assume what they're talking about is the West Coast of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the missiles alone are not the danger. It's what you can attach to it. So what kind of capabilities, if you could just recap for us, does North Korea have right now?
Yeah, Melinda, I think that's really the key point. The missiles by themselves are of almost no interest if they're not mated with nuclear weapons. And I say nuclear, not just weapons of mass destruction, because this is not an efficient way for a country like North Korea to deliver biological or chemical weapons. This is really a matter of being a threat to the United States, only and only if they acquire nuclear weapons, and weapons which are they have developed in the proper size, i.e. small, so they can put atop this missile and lift that kind of payload. Right now, the assessment of the intelligence community is that it is more likely than not that North Korea has one or possibly two nuclear weapons. And this, if they do, it comes from plutonium that the North Koreans separated around 1989, 1990, 1991, in that time frame. What we are concerned about, of course, and why we have whatever the administration may wish to call it. I believe we have a crisis now, is the possibly imminent separation of additional plutonium. There is in spent nuclear fuel that is in storage 30 kilograms of plutonium, which translates to around 5 or 6 nuclear weapons, and that could be available to the North Koreans in a matter of months. It would take them some more months to fabricate weapons. Not weapons, I want to add, that they could plausibly put atop missiles, because they would, I think by most estimates, not be of the weight that they could lift with the missiles that we are now talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we are talking with Robert Gallucci, the ambassador at large in the Clinton administration who negotiated the agreed framework with North Korea, and we are talking about the current situation with North Korea and its nuclear capabilities, and we welcome your calls. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Now, the board of the International Atomic Energy Agency voted this week, yesterday, to refer this North Korean nuclear issue to the UN Security Council. This could lead to the possibility of sanctions against North Korea. First of all, how probable is that? And secondly, how effective would those be?
I will speak to how probable and effective, but let's do probable, because I think it's massively improbable. No one that I know of wants to have sanctions voted against North Korea, not the United States. Not South Korea, not Japan, not the countries in the region. I don't think anybody on the Security Council favors that, because all that would do would be to make a situation which now is quite serious even worse, and there's no expectation, I think, on anyone's part that sanctions would stop the North Korean program. We cannot bring North Korea to its knees through international sanctions, because China will not let that happen. So I think it's extremely unlikely, and if they were to be voted, I think they would only have bad effect.
Right, right. We go now to Rance, who's in O'Fallon, Illinois. Welcome, Rance.
Hello. Could you clarify the 94 treaty with North Korea for me? It's my understanding that the treaty only addressed plutonium nuclear weapons and ignored uranium-based, which the North Koreans worked on, and from what I heard, the first persons to violate the treaty was the U.S. when it stopped its shipments.
Mm-hmm. Robert Gallucci?
Yes. The caller's on to a number of good points. First, very briefly, the 94 Accord is really fairly complicated, but an overview is that we, the United States, wished to stop a North Korean plutonium-based nuclear weapons program that involved a research reactor at 5 megawatts, construction of a 50-megawatt reactor, and construction of a 200-megawatt reactor, plus a chemical separation plant to pull out the plutonium from the fuel. That was the program we wanted to stop, and we were worried about producing, when it was completed, roughly 150 kilograms of plutonium a year, which is about 30 weapons a year. So it was a very large and serious program. And we negotiated the framework in order to freeze and ultimately dismantle that program. Under the terms of that accord, the North Koreans got a number of good things that they wished. They got the commitment to construct large light water reactors at a cost of about $5 or $6 billion. That's $1 billion that the Japanese and South Koreans were financing. And also the delivery every year of something called heavy fuel oil to compensate the North Koreans for giving up the energy that they would have gotten from the reactor that was already operating. Mm-hmm. And we, the United States, was essentially paying that bill. Mm-hmm. That was the deal. It did not, as the caller correctly notes, mention highly enriched uranium. At the time we negotiated it, of course, we knew that there was always a risk that there would be a secret centrifuge program. I was asked about that in testimony, and the answer then was that we would have to use our national technical means, which is a term of art for our intelligence capability, satellites and other means, to watch North Korea very carefully.
Would it not have been, in afterthought, would it not have been good back then to have included the creation of uranium the uranium as well as plutonium in this.
Melinda, yes, that I feel like I'm back in 1994. It would have been good, in fact, not to deliver two large power reactors, which also produce plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been good to cure cancer and a whole lot of other things. We did, and I take responsibility for this on behalf of the government at the time, we made the best deal we could. To add additional transparency at that point did not seem plausible to us.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to stop the plutonium program. That we knew was a certainty. Could they cheat? We all knew that I had crawled over the Iraqi program as an inspector. We had discovered a lot of stuff that was hidden from the intelligence community, and we asked the rhetorical question, who digs tunnels better than anyone on Earth? And that would be the North Koreans. So we always knew that there was a possibility the North Koreans would cheat, and they did, and they got caught. And so we find ourselves where we do now. The caller asked another question, and that was whether we, the United States, did not, she said, I believe, violate the agreement. It's really not a technical agreement, but did we act inconsistent with it when we decided the keto countries, this Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization that implements the deal, that's Japan, South Korea, the European Union, and the United States, we decided not to continue the delivery of that heavy fuel oil. Did we violate the terms? I would say no, not at all, because the North Koreans committed, if there was such a thing as a material breach to a non-agreement, this is a material breach. They cheated fundamentally on what the deal was intended to accomplish, namely the end of their nuclear weapons program when they started a secret gas centrifuge program to enrich uranium.
And so now we find ourselves again potentially heading to talks, but North Korea wants the talks. The U.S. is saying no unilateral, sitting down at a table. It has to be multilateral, invoking the U.N.
Mm-hmm.
What's the wisdom in that?
Well, I don't believe there's much wisdom at all, frankly. I understand, I believe, that the administration wishes to have this issue viewed as an international and multilateral one, and in that, I think they're quite correct. And having it insisting that the IAEA board report it to the Security Council, I think, was also exactly the right thing to do. I begin to part company with the administration when they take the position that they, though, will not deal directly with North Koreans because that would reward bad behavior, and that is just what the North Koreans want. It is indeed just what the North Koreans want, but it also happens to be what the South Koreans, the Japanese, every other member of the Security Council, and I think every other country on Earth that looks at this wants, because it is a way of engaging the North Koreans and unplugging this crisis. It is not really consistent with the philosophy and of the administration with respect to how one deals with rogues such as North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that philosophy is ultimately in the national security interests of the United States. I think they're making a big mistake.
Right. Well, just very briefly, I'd like to hear your comment just in a few seconds, if you could. CIA Director George Tenet said the other day the domino theory of the 21st century may well be nuclear. So I'm wondering if this pattern of developing, now encouraging rogue states to get, does encourage them to get nuclear weapons, because if you have them, you have more bargaining power.
No, I don't really think the international arena is the playground, and you have to worry about a candy bar here leading to another bad behavior there to get a candy bar. States are going to respond in their own international context, their own regional context. We have a problem with Iran. Iran, I don't believe, is learning anything from North Korea. The dominoes
mm-hmm.
that we refer to really go to what might happen if North Korea acquires a weapon. We need to worry about Japan's non-nuclear commitment. We need to worry about South Korea's non-nuclear equipment.
Right, right. Robert Gallucci, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Gallucci is Dean of the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and was ambassador at large and negotiated the agreed framework with North Korea. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we plan to broaden this discussion. The U.S. approach to Iraq and the U.S. approach to North Korea are about as different as you can get. One looks to war, the other to negotiations. How important is it to be consistent in foreign policy? Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm Melinda Penkava. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington. We've been talking so far this hour about North Korea and its nuclear program, but the U.S. approach gets a little bit sticky when you add in Iraq. If negotiations at the U.N. or elsewhere are good enough for North Korea, why not for Iraq? If war is the approach for Iraq, why not for North Korea? In other words, how important is it to be consistent in foreign policy? How important is it to follow principles? And what do you gain from consistency? And what do you lose? We invite you to join this conversation about principles and pragmatism. Our number here is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. The email address, totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Joseph Nye, Dean of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. He is author of The Paradox of American Power and was a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs during the Clinton administration. Welcome, Joseph Nye.
Glad to be with you.
Well, is it possible or even feasible that the U.S. can have a consistent approach to foreign policy, one size fits all?
Well, one size never fits all perfectly, but it helps to have some principles, a sense of direction where you're going, but at the same time you have to be pragmatic in terms of adapting. The world doesn't always fit. That was one of the problems that the current administration ran into when the president called North Korea, Iraq, and Iran an axis of evil. It was good rhetoric for the home front, but it lumped together three very disparate types of diplomatic situations, and now that's come back to haunt them.
It's like there's three different wheels on that axis.
That's right.
Different sized tires.
It needs a slightly different approach and different solution, and lumping them together, I think, may have made our diplomacy more difficult rather than easier.
Mm-hmm. Now, this idea of pragmatism and principle, which do you think has the upper hand?
Well, I think there's always a tension in American foreign policy. It's not a partisan issue. It's not an issue for this administration. We need to set out principles to have some sense of where we're going, but we often find that we have to make adjustments. I mean, think all the way back to the end of the beginning of the Cold War in the 1940s when we announced the doctrine of containment of communism in the 1940s, but then under President Truman, we wound up supporting communist Yugoslavia. And the reason we did was not that Tito wasn't Marshal Tito, the dictator of Yugoslavia at the time, was a communist dictator, but he was a thorn in the side of the Soviet Union, so we supported him. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say, wasn't that departing from our principles?
Against communism.
Against communism. The answer is yes, but as a practical matter, it was a way of weakening our enemy, the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing new about this. This has been a long-standing problem of foreign policy.
Does pragmatism always trump principle then?
No, I think it's important that if you let pragmatism always prevail and you have no sense of direction, then you're blown about like the wind. There's what I call soft power, which is our ability to attract others. Hard power is our ability to coerce others or use carrots and sticks. Soft power is the ability to attract others. And the fact that we stand for democracy or human rights makes others want to follow us. And it's a lot easier if people want to follow you than if you have to spend on carrots and sticks to force them to do what you don't want. So having principles which are attractive to others is actually an important part of our soft power. The problem with that is that when you don't live up to those principles, you get accused of hypocrisy, and then you lose the benefits you get from that soft power. You tend to squander it. So that getting the right balance between principles and pragmatism is one of the hardest parts of foreign policy.
And I imagine some of the difficulty here is because the pragmatism and the principles are not written down in any one place. I mean, we speak generally of a foreign policy, but it's not as if there is something that is written down that this is the foreign policy of the country.
Well, most presidents try to write down something at an abstract level. It comes out in their speeches, or most recently the Bush administration issued a national security strategy in September of last year. The Clinton administration had a similar national security strategy, but they tend to be at fairly high levels of abstraction, which don't give you the secret when it comes to solving a particular problem like
right.
North Korea or Iraq.
I mean, it's easier then to say that you didn't deviate much from your policy if it's very vague.
Well, or the policy sounds very good at a high level of abstraction, and incidentally, I think the national security strategy of September 2002 has some very ringing and reaffirming abstract terms. Some people call it Wilsonianism, after Woodrow Wilson,
mm-hmm.
But in this case of the right rather than the left. But the question of what does that tell you to do about Iran, or what do you do about North Korea, doesn't really help you answer those problems.
Right, right. I'm wondering if this, the different approaches that are being taken to Iraq and North Korea, is that going to get the U.S. in trouble in terms of that soft power concept you were speaking about a second ago?
Well, it does for those who believe that that the Americans don't have principles and are just cynical. I mean, there are a number of people overseas, both in Europe and in the Arab world, who think that we're being driven into or lured into Iraq because we want to control Iraq's oil. I don't think for a minute that that's the case, but when they look at our behavior and they say, wait a minute, North Korea has an evil leader, it is actually closer to making nuclear weapons than Iraq is, and yet you're not going after them the way you're going after Iraq, it must be then you have ulterior motives, such as oil. That then reduces the attractiveness of our position. So, yeah, there are problems, which is when it appears to be an inconsistency between two cases, people sometimes attribute the wrong motives to the reasons why you're treating them differently.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK is our number. We're speaking with Joseph Nye, and you can join the conversation. We'll go to Joel, who's in Panama City, Florida. Hi there, Joel.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you doing?
I'm well. I was just calling to say that I believe that it's all right to treat different nations with different policies, and the reason I think that is if you take that down to a kind of personal level, you deal with different people in different ways because they'll respond to different stimuli. And to try to apply the same concepts or the same principles to everybody in exactly the same way is like trying to place everybody in the box and saying, for instance, North Korea and Iraq are exactly the same animal, which, as your guest is saying, is absolutely incorrect.
Joseph Nye?
I think that's right. I think, in fact, the administration is correct to treat Iraq and North Korea differently because the situations are different. I think the mistake they made was the original mistake of using the rhetoric of axis of evil to lump them all together. There's not much to choose between Saddam Hussein and Kim Jong-il in terms of their being nasty or evil people, but the situations are very different. For example, North Korea has 11,000 artillery tubes in caves in the demilitarized zone that are within about 40 miles of Seoul, and so they could devastate Seoul with conventional weapons. Iraq doesn't have that capability. So in 1994, when we looked at a similar situation about North Korea's threats to depart from the Non-Proliferation Treaty and so forth, one of the first things that we looked at in the Clinton administration was the idea of an airstrike to take out their nuclear reprocessing facilities. But when we looked at the response that that would have in terms of damage to our South Korean allies, we realized that that option didn't look so good. So I think the difference between North Korea and Iraq is that deterrence works, only in this case it's deterrence of us. And we might as well be realistic about that and realize then that we're going to have to find negotiations and some other solution. And that Iraq and North Korea are different situations, even though the leaders are perhaps equally unattractive.
And that's because one has gotten farther down that track on with weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah, the North Koreans are further along toward a nuclear weapon than Iraq is. Mm-hmm. But actually, it's worth noticing that the deterrence rests not just on nuclear, but on conventional capacity. They just have because it's only 40 miles from their artillery tubes from there to Seoul, they could just lay waste a modern city of a major ally by conventional means.
Mm-hmm. Numbers come into this, too, of what would be the result if, say, the U.S. were to go to war with North Korea, just as it's talking about going to war with Iraq. I mean, their calculation has to be made that there would be X number of deaths in one and X number in another. Does that not fit into those calculations, to proceed?
It clearly does. I mean, the casualties, nobody knows in advance, but you do estimates of but the estimated casualties in North Korea in a war there would be much, much higher than in Iraq. Now, obviously, accidents can happen, surprises can happen. Iraq might turn out to be worse than expected and so forth. But on first estimates, the order of magnitude of casualties, both on the North Korean and the Iraqi side and on the Allied side, they're very, very different.
1-800-989-8255 is the number. We'll go to Little Rock, Arkansas. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Linda. I have to agree with most of what your guest is saying. I'm not a real big supporter of the Bush administration's approach to our foreign policy in general, especially Iraq. But I have to say I do agree with their approach to North Korea, although it does have a negative effect as far as how we look consistency-wise.
So you're okay with that inconsistency because
right.
you prefer
it's
that approach?
I think it's a big problem for our allies, you know, and so it makes it hard for them to want to step up and help us out.
I think that's the right answer, but I think that it does. There's a moral to the story then, which is be careful about how you proclaim things, because you don't want to have to eat crow later. And so that means that in the rhetoric we use, we have to be more cautious in not lumping things together, which we're going to wind up having to treat differently. And we also have to be open with the public, both at home and abroad, as to why we're treating different cases differently.
Yeah.
So essentially the actions that the caller points out to are justified that they're treated differently because they are different. But then we have to think back and say, well, why was it we got into trouble? And it's because our words sort of lump together things where our actions couldn't lump them together.
As I understand what you're saying, Rachel, is you're preferring half a loaf rather than no loaf at all here. You would
yeah.
prefer that the administration take that the same approach that they're doing with North Korea with Iraq?
Not exactly. I know that they're different situations. I just don't appreciate the rhetoric being used mm-hmm. in regard to Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think that it's harmful rather than helpful. We may end up in the same scenario either way, but I don't appreciate the rhetoric and the approach, and I think that it's much more reasonable the rhetoric and approach to North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for your call, Rachel.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Nate is in Muncie, Indiana. Hi there, Nate.
Hello. I would just like to make a comment that whatever avenue approach our government chooses when dealing with any public policy issue would be dictated more by the end result we are trying to achieve than any other matter. Because we'd have to take a different approach when dealing with North Korea and trying to deter them from using nuclear weapons because of the possible danger than if we're trying to be proactive in stopping future terrorist attacks.
Is it so much the end result that we have to take into account or the price of getting to the end result?
I believe it's the end result because the cost is going to be there no matter what. We just have to choose what we're willing to accept and what we're not.
Joseph Nye?
Well, I mean, we care about the end result and we care about the cost. Obviously, in terms of end result, if you said, I'm going to stop North Korea getting a nuclear weapon, we could indeed carry out a preemptive strike against the reprocessing plant at Yongbyon, destroy the reactors and the reprocessing plant. The North Koreans have said if we do that, they will unleash war, which will include the devastation of Seoul. So if all you care is the end result of stopping their nuclear reprocessing, you can do it, but the price is going to be higher than I think we want to pay. And if one of the prices for us is that we lose our alliance with South Korea, that's an extremely high price. So I think you have to look at both the objective and the price.
Nate?
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I want to get back to this idea about the inconsistency, because it is one of the criticisms that do come up with folks who don't agree with what the administration is doing. They, perhaps with Iraq, first of all, and then they say, well, how can the administration take this approach to Iraq if it's taking that approach to North Korea? How could you explain that to people, Joseph Nye?
Well, I if I were to step back and ask what are the major threats that we face, meaning the United States, I'd say the greatest threat is Al-Qaeda, and the second greatest is North Korea because they're closer to getting nuclear weapons in Iraq, and the third is Iraq. But there is a real threat from Iraq, and it's the threat of letting somebody like Saddam Hussein get weapons of mass destruction and to flout UN resolutions. And I think that is a justification for using force to prevent that. So I've sometimes said that Iraq is maybe the right war at the wrong time. But given where we are now, it's not a question of could you rerun history and said, did they get the right ranking of these crises, but where we are on the tree, where do we go from here? And I think probably given the branch we're on, it's better to go ahead on Iraq than to turn around and return to the evasive diplomacy of the 1990s, where Saddam Hussein wiggles off the hook and continues to develop weapons of mass destruction. So what you face in foreign policy are often not merely what would be the ideal situation if you started with a clean slate, but given where you are now, what are the decisions you make?
Mm-hmm.
And so from my point of view, I may not have gotten to where they are now, but given where they are now, I think I would feel it's better to go ahead than to turn around.
Mm-hmm. We go to Wes in Boston. Welcome, Wes.
Hi. Vinay, I have a question for you. I wonder if you think this inconsistency in policy toward North Korea and Iraq might backfire over the long term, since effectively North Korea is deterring the United States by its possession of nuclear, chemical, biological weapons, and its threatening of South Korea, whereas Iraq doesn't have this. And if a rogue state leader in the future might take a lesson from this and say, well, hey, if I want to keep the U.S. off my back, I better get my weapons fast and early and threaten my neighbor. That way I won't be in a situation like Saddam and boxed in.
I think that's exactly right. There is a danger of that the lessons that will be learned is do it secretly, do it fast, and then the Americans can't get you. That's why, in fact, as I said in answer to the earlier point, was I would have ranked the North Koreans first on my list after Al-Qaeda rather than second on my list. But, you know, that's it's too late for that now because the ranking is going the other way. One of the problems, though, is that right now it's very hard to deal with two crises at the same time, and we're not spending enough attention to the North Korean crisis as we should. So I would like to see the administration move a little more rapidly on the North Korean front.
Mm-hmm. Wes, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Joseph Nye, are there certain principles that should never be compromised in foreign policy?
Yeah, I'll give you one. The London Economist, which is a magazine which is generally very supportive of the United States, had on the cover about a month ago the argument of torture. Would the United States be justified in using torture in the war on terrorism? And there were accusations, which I guess were put in the Washington Post, I don't know they were ever publicly answered by the administration, said that sometimes there have been excesses in which we've either resorted to torture or shipped individuals to places where we knew they'd be tortured by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the Economist made the point that once we start breaching that really fundamental human right, we're starting to lose what we're all about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the you know, there are some principles which we ought to be awfully careful not to breach.
And we have to breach here right now. We have to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Joseph Nye and take your calls, 1-800-989-8255. I'm Melinda Penkava. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington. Right now at Talk of the Nation, we continue our discussion about consistency and principle in foreign policy. Our guest is Joseph Nye, Dean of the JFK School of Government at Harvard and author of The Paradox of American Power. You can join the conversation. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. The email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Well, Joseph Nye, we've been focusing on the present situation, Iraq, North Korea. Could you give us some examples of other times in American history or in history in general when governments have been faced with a similar foreign policy dilemma?
Yeah, we saw this quite often in the Cold War. We claimed that the Cold War was for basic liberties. We saw ourselves as the leader of the free world, and yet we wound up supporting governments like the Shah of Iran and General Park, who took over as president of South Korea. In those cases, what we were doing was saying the danger of Soviet movement down to the Persian Gulf through Iran is sufficient to justify supporting the Shah for stability in the region. Or in South Korea, we said, yes, we do support democracy and human rights in South Korea, but in the meantime, there's an even worse government in North Korea which wants to invade South Korea. So we'll put up with a dictator who arbitrarily arrests and tortures and kills people rather than see the North Koreans take over. So we faced a lot of these trade-offs in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Now, those are trade-offs. Was it ever a situation such as what we are at now, where there's the brink of war? I realize in the Cold War there was Vietnam, that was the ongoing conflict. But was there ever a time when there was this type of a special attention to this idea of treating one country one way and another a different way?
Well, I think the South Korean case is illustrative here, which is that there were several cases where there was a fear that a Korean War could break out again. Remember, the North Koreans actually attacked the whole South Korea, or a large part of the South Korean cabinet, killed a large number of them when they were overseas and on a visit to Burma. Kim Il-sung, the former dictator of North Korea, actually dug four tunnels under the demilitarized zone to allow troops to rush across into South Korea. So there was a fear of war on the Korean Peninsula, and that meant that we had to be concerned about the ability of the South Koreans to defend themselves and about the presence of fifth columns and subversion by North Koreans inside South Koreans. North Koreans used to send raiding parties into South Korea to infiltrate people into the country to do damage behind the lines. So that was a trade-off where there was a fear that that a war could break out and that we had to be prepared, and that led us to, tolerate things in authoritarian South Korea that we might not have tolerated if it had been far away from the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also worth noting, incidentally, that we kept nudging quietly and perhaps not as effectively as necessary, nudging in the direction of democracy and human rights. And when conditions began to change in the later 1980s, South Korea did begin to evolve toward a democratic regime, which they have today. And American diplomats and military commanders were quietly pressing for more openness in South Korea as they moved in that direction.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll go to Scott now in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Fine. How are you? Did you have a question for Joseph Nye?
I do. My question is this. I've been listening to a lot of the discussion lately. It's really interesting, but sometimes I wonder if there's not a double standard. Like, if the United States is allowed to have a nuclear weapons program, in the abstract level, why can't another country like North Korea or Iraq, for that matter, develop a nuclear weapons program if they want? And do you know what I mean?
Well, there has been a double standard on the development or proliferation of nuclear weapons since the Non-Proliferation Treaty was negotiated and signed in the 1970s, or 1960s, actually, late 1960s. And the argument went something like this, that the five states that already had nuclear weapons would undertake to not let the escalation of their nuclear arsenals go on forever, but that there was a greater danger if you had the spread of nuclear weapons to a large number of countries, because the more countries that had it, the more likelihood that some accident would occur, somebody would lose control, and so forth. When President Kennedy was thinking about the future of the spread of nuclear weapons in the early 1960s, he expected to see about 25 nuclear weapon states by the 1970s. In fact, they're probably there are the five declared states and about three others in the world today, which is a lot better than we've seen. The argument, I think, as to why it's legitimate to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons is that there's a much higher prospect that they will be sometimes used as they spread to a larger number of countries, but B, to countries that in some cases are willing to take greater risks, such as Iraq or North Korea, and C, to some countries which have weaker internal control systems. So in terms of the consequences, I think that you can make an argument that it's not totally hypocritical or inconsistent.
Okay, thank you for your call, Scott. We go to Louisa, who's in Newport Beach in California. Hi there, Louisa.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. As I look at how the world views us in this present situation, is there a way to conduct a foreign policy that will garner a modicum of respect, and still using, you know, being pragmatic and taking each situation as a separate situation. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Louise.
I think there is, in the sense that it's important that we not be arrogant in our foreign policy. There's a group of people who call themselves the new unilateralists. This is a term that was coined by the columnist Charles Krauthammer. And what he said is, we're so big and so strong that we can do whatever we want. You know, our defense expenditure is equal to the next 24 countries combined. And rather than be tied down by, pygmies or Lilliputians who tie Gulliver down, we should just go ahead and do what we want. This is the new unilateralism. And there's some people in the administration who follow that view. There are others who think that that's a mistake. The danger is if you act that way, arrogantly, you're likely to offend others. You're likely to create resistance. You're likely to squander your soft or attractive power.
Now, is there a way to be big and not be resented?
Yeah, and yes and no. I mean, the big kid on the block always has a certain amount of admiration and resentment mixed. Hmm. But how you calibrate your policy can get that ratio in the right ways to have more admiration and less resentment. But when you treat others like dirt or don't pay attention to them or say we're so big we don't have to listen to you, that's the way to increase the resentment part of the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the great danger of the new unilateralism. It's not that unilateralism isn't sometimes justified, and it's not that multilateral answers are always perfect, but it is a point that something that President Bush said in the campaign of 2000. He said, if we're a humble nation, others will respect us, and if we're arrogant, they will not. Now, the administration hasn't always followed that good advice, and it sometimes comes out differently, let's say, from the State Department, which does tend to follow that advice, from the Defense Department, which sometimes doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a tension in the administration, in the Congress, in the journalistic corps and op-ed writers in America today, and if we would be a little bit more observant of Teddy Roosevelt's advice that when you have a big stick, speak softly, I think we would be do a lot better.
Well, Joseph Nye, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Joseph Nye is dean of the JFK School of Government at Harvard and author of The Paradox of American Power.